Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of And You Resum the Top Text, a podcast about memes, internet culture, and whatever. So today is the Halloween special episode. You've read the title, you know what the fuck is going on. And we are gonna read scary stories to each other. And that's gonna be really fucking spooky. Steph!
Yes?
You're probably the most and best prepared of us. We can start with you.
All right, I found a couple of spooky stories that made me get goosebumps all over. This one is called The New House, and it's a little bit long, and these are allegedly true stories that have happened to people. So...
Allegedly.
Alleged.
I've also found non-fiction. Actually, I found a great Reddit thread. What are the scariest pages on Wikipedia? I picked a few ones, so it's all real non-fiction. There's also a really, really scary story about a virus that is infecting the whole world, and so people have to hide inside their houses. But I don't have to tell it because we're all living it right now.
All right, so let's get spooky. This story is called The New House. Just a quick backstory. Almost every house I've ever lived in has had some sort of paranormal goings on, and I've written about two other houses already if you want to check it out. My younger brother, who's 21, has a history of night terrors, and my mum, who's 46, claims to have always been sensitive. I guess it runs in the family or something. I've only told this story a couple of times because it makes me very emotional, and trust me, I've gone over all of the possibilities, paranormal or otherwise. When we moved into this house, it was 2013. I was about to start my senior year of high school, and my brother, we'll call him Tristan, was about to start 8th grade. At the time, our Yorkie, Tiny, and our Chihuahua, Lucy, had four puppies. Our other dog, Bugsy, is blind, and he plays a key role in realizing maybe something wasn't right with the house from the very beginning. He would never walk far down the hallway. Every time he would get to the bathroom, he would always stop and back out of the hallway. All of the bedrooms were down the hall past the bathroom. This is important for later. When we moved in, we kept the puppies next to the bathroom in a cardboard box to keep them all in one place, since even though they were newborns, they were starting to learn how to walk a little bit, and we didn't want to lose any of them since they were so small. On the morning of the incident, we had probably been living in the house for a few months already. So far, nothing out of the norm has happened, and it was actually a huge relief for me. Tristan hadn't been sleepwalking, walking, or having night terrors. My mum hadn't heard us calling her name when we weren't there, and I wasn't afraid that when the lights were off or when I was taking a shower. That morning, the sun was out and the house was well lit. I walked out of my room to get to the bathroom in the hall so I could get ready for school. My mum was in my way because she was cuddling one of the puppies, so I asked her to move so I could get to the bathroom. I was watching her the entire time, so when she put the puppy down, his name was Petey, it came as a shock to me when she stood up really fast and started crying and apologizing to me that she dropped him. I told her she didn't drop him because I just watched her put him down. He was fine. He didn't cry or anything, and he was placed down, not dropped. Even after trying to reassure her, she picked Petey up again and hurried over to the kitchen island and sat down on the bar stool and cuddled up to him, whispering something over and over. I didn't really think too much of it, since my mum can be quite dramatic at times, so I just kind of brushed it off and continued to get ready for school. When I came into the kitchen to make my lunch, my mum was still sitting at the island cuddling Petey and whispering how sorry she was and that he was going to be okay. I don't remember what I said, but at this point I was being snotty and probably said something along the lines of, "You're acting like a crazy lady." Normally she would say something shitty back to me, but she didn't even acknowledge what I said, which is definitely not normal for her, so I turned around to witness something horrifying. She stood up out of the bar stool, cupping Petey in her hands, and had him cuddled up to her neck. She was staring into space and looking at nothing in particular, but then her head dropped forward and her arms dropped to her sides all in one fluid motion, and she obviously dropped Petey. I heard a little yelp from Petey and screamed at my mum, who was still standing there with her head dropped forward and her arms dangling by her sides. "What did you do? Why would you do that?" She didn't respond to me, but she leaned down to pick Petey up and she cupped him in her hands and snuggled him up against her neck again. As soon as she was positioned, she did the exact same thing in the exact same way, and I just stood there again with her head drooped forward and her arms dangling by her sides. I couldn't believe what I just saw, and I couldn't move. I couldn't even form words at this point, so all I could do was scream. When I screamed, my mum looked up at me and let out this blood-curdling scream and dove face forward into the wall of the island counter. Then silence. I couldn't hear Petey. I couldn't hear my mum. I couldn't move. I don't know how long I stood there, but it felt like I was frozen in time, and everything I just witnessed seemed to happen in slow motion. Then I heard the bar stools scooting around, and my mum stood up. I was half expecting to see a bloody nose, but I didn't have time to look, because as soon as she stood up with her arms dangling by her sides, she fell forward like she was doing on a purpose, and did not raise her arms to stop her fall, and I heard her face make contact with the tile floor. I felt this sense of dread, and I don't know why I couldn't move to help her, because clearly there was something wrong. All I could do was scream. Every time I screamed, she would get up again and fall forward or backwards the second she was upright. It wasn't that she couldn't hold herself up. It was like she was intentionally free-falling to make sure her head and face would make direct contact with the tile. When she fell for the last time, it was in front of Tristan. He heard me screaming and came out of his room to see what was going on. The second he entered the kitchen, my mum spread her arms out wide to the side like Jesus on the cross. I'm sorry if that offends you, but that is exactly how she positioned herself. Her and my brother stared at each other for a few seconds, and my mum fell back and smacked her hard on the tile so that it sounded like her skull cracked. My brother looked down at our mum and then back up at me. He turned around and walked his ass straight back to his room and shut the door. I know some of you may think it's fucked up, but he's different and I don't blame him for it. At this point, somehow, I'm standing over my mum. I don't remember leaving my spot in the kitchen, but I'm screaming at my mum to wake up. I'm scared to touch her because I don't know how hurt she is. She could have had a spinal cord injury from jumping headfirst into the island counter, maybe a broken nose or face. But now that I'm getting a good look at her, there's nothing. No blood, no bumps, only a little bit of redness. At this point, I stood up to call 911 because there's just no way she's not injured. But before I could get up to the phone, my mum got up and grabbed her keys and said, "All right, you guys ready to go?" Guys, I was stunned. Did I just imagine all that bullshit? There's no way I'm getting in the car with this woman, because for all I know, she'll drive us all off a cliff. Something inside me was telling me this episode wasn't over. I asked her to give me the keys, and she got really mad at me and told me no. That little voice inside me was telling me to take charge, so I demanded she give me the keys in the most authoritative voice I could muster up at that moment. She slammed her keys down on the kitchen island, and I told her to sit down on the couch in the living room. I finally had my phone, and I didn't know who to call. I was afraid to call the police, so I decided to call my aunt instead. Before I dialed the number, my mum asked for a puppy to hold. That's when I remembered Petey. I didn't see him around anywhere, so he wasn't injured enough to not be able to get away and hide. Naturally, I told her no, she could not hold a puppy right now. But that's when she completely changed. "But I want to hold a puppy, please." That was not my mother. That was not her voice. It sounded like a toddler. Not like she was whining like a toddler. It's like she was a toddler. At this point, my heart was pounding. I dialed my aunt's number and the phone started ringing. When I turned to keep my eye on my mum, she was trying to sneak off the couch like a little kid trying to sneak out of time out. In the back of my mind, I thought if she was going to act like a child, I needed to act like as an authority figure. So I snapped at her and said, "Get your ass back on that couch right now or I'm giving the puppies away." To my surprise, she listened and sat back on the couch and just cried. My aunt didn't answer, so I called my cousin. She wasn't picking up either, but I knew she didn't answer the phone when she was driving, so I kept calling over and over again so that maybe she would pick up on the fact that something was wrong. Up until this point, I haven't cried once, but as soon as my cousin answered the phone with a "Stalkers are us, why are you blowing up my phone?" I burst into tears. I'm not a crier, so when I started crying, my cousin started panicking, and all I could say is, "Something is wrong with my mum, and I need someone to come get me and Tristan." I didn't need to say more, so she got a hold of our aunt and I knew someone was on their way. I turned my attention back to my mum and she was totally fine. When I got off the phone, she looked really confused and said her head hurt and asked why I was crying. I couldn't even look at her and told her to stay away from me. I was screaming and crying and begging her not to get up and to stay on the couch. I remember just screaming at her and asking why she dropped Petey, and she was acting so confused and scared that I was acting like that, so she started crying too. I was frantically looking for Petey, and I found him hiding behind some packing boxes, just terrified. I picked him up and held him until my aunt got to our house. When my aunt got to our house, I begged her to take my mum to the hospital to get a CAT scan or something because I really thought she had to be hurt, or at the very least she was having a mental breakdown or something. Mum refused to go until we took Petey to the animal hospital to make sure he was okay first, but at the same time she was still really confused, and so was my aunt. I couldn't really come to terms with what I'd witnessed, and I was scared of my mum. I didn't tell my aunt what happened until we dropped Mum off at the hospital. I begged to go to school because I didn't want to be at my house and I didn't want to see my mum, so she agreed to drop me off and pick me up at the end of the day. After school, my aunt picked me up and then my brother. We all went to get my mum from the hospital. All they told the hospital is that my mum fell a few times and hit her head, but they found absolutely no injuries. No bruising, no swelling, no fractures. There was nothing. My mum didn't remember anything at all other than hearing me scream. But when my aunt told my mum everything I told her, she got really weird and called someone to meet us at the house. When we got home, there was this guy I'd never met waiting for us. Apparently, he was a pastor who has experience with spiritual warfare. At the time, I was not religious. Sometimes I would say I was an atheist, and other times I would say I was agnostic. But I could tell you that I didn't know what to believe. I could only tell you what I saw. The pastor opened every door in the house and put oil over every open door. As soon as he started praying out loud, all of the dogs went crazy. They were barking and howling. As quickly as it all started, it all stopped. We closed the front and back door to our shack. Bugsy waltzed right down the hall past the bathroom and for the very first time laid on the floor of my mum's bedroom. I refused to hear the explanation of everything because I was so shaken up. But apparently there was something looming in the bathroom in the hallway. My mum remembered before she put Petey down, before getting out of my way so I could go to the bathroom. She remembered that Petey's face contorted and his tongue stuck out. She said the best way she could explain it was that Petey looked like his face had turned into a cartoon and stuck his tongue out at her. And because it happened so fast, she thought maybe she dropped him and he was having a seizure or something. Then she remembered panicking for a second and remembered nothing after that. For those of you concerned about Petey, he was perfectly fine as well. He was afraid of my mum for a day or so but went back to his playful self. My mum does not have a history of mental illness, and nothing like that has ever happened since. We don't really talk about it to this day, other than my brother and I telling our sister. My mum and my brother still live in that house, and as far as I know, nothing has happened since. Well, at least not inside the house. But that's a story for another time. That one gave me the goosebumps when I read it, like the fucking visual image of like the head lolling and like falling over and over again and like smacking her head into the tiles. I fucking hate demon shit.
I sounded sore, and anything that involves animals has always got that extra level of like spookiness to it.
You know what it reminded me of though, at the end where they talk about like the puppy's tongue sticking out? Did you guys ever watch Jim Carrey's The Mask?
Oh, a long time ago.
Right at the end, his little Jack Russell Terrier puts the mask on and he turns into exactly that, like the big head and like the snaky tongue and things like that. I could not get Jim Carrey's The Mask out of my head when I was reading that. But that one gave me the goosebumps, so.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
So what's our verdict? Did it really happen?
I mean, I'm a pretty big believer in like the spiritual stuff and like demons and things like that. So it depends on what you believe in. For me, if there was some shit like infesting that house, then that's possible. It could have happened. But yeah, I think it's like, I guess, totally up to what you believe in.
Guys, what do you think?
It's one of those things where obviously people can suffer from all kinds of stuff in their head sometimes. Mm. So up until the point where the pastor got involved, I was like, you know what, this could be just like some serious mental health stuff maybe. Mm. But like as soon as he mentioned the pasta thing, I was like, right, this is where this is going. You know, I'm not I've never had any of those sort of weird experiences, anything paranormal, nothing, none of that has ever happened to me, so I struggle to you know, deal with that stuff a lot of the time.
I never had any paranormal stuff happening to me, but I have had hallucinations relatively often, and what it sounded to me is like the mom might have been fine. What it sounded to me is like the narrator was hallucinating, and when they said at the hospital that the mom that didn't have any injuries or whatever, it comforted me in that belief. I think probably the person who's, if the person is not lying, is making this up, probably the person who wrote this had some kind of hallucination or mental stuff. That's what I think.
Interesting.
The way it was narrated, the way it was written, struck me as not normal, not some normal person who had a bad experience. It struck me as someone talking about like a nightmare that they had, or it sounded like the person had a hallucination. That's how they feel like okay. Stuff happening again and again.
Especially when the brother walked out. Because, you know, if there was something actually going on and the brother just walked out, that seems super, like, what's going on there?
Mm.
Because if that kind of shit happened and I just walked in, I would probably try and do something.
Yeah, if it was your mum, you'd be trying to...
Even if it was someone I didn't like... If something like that happened, I would feel the need to, like, intervene.
But if I
walked out, going with that theory, if I'd walked out as the brother and just seen the mum being like, what's going on? And the kid just screaming and being like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? I'd be like, I'm not touching this, and walk out. That makes more sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
Yep.
But if I'd seen my mum, you know, smacking her head against Tyle and, like, being very injured, I wouldn't walk away from that. Like, I'd be... restraining her, you know, being like, stop hurting yourself, you know.
A lot of people say that you shouldn't restrain people if they're having like seizures or anything. That's like true. It's a difficult one,
but don't you have to, because I know you're not supposed to touch people who are having seizures, but I think also you're supposed to keep them safe, right? Like make sure they're not
you should
clear the area.
You shouldn't restrain them, but like you can break their fall by like grabbing on their arm and letting them, because if they fall and they hurt their head, I mean, it's not 100%. I'm going to oversimplify this, but if you fall on your face, it's basically impossible to get very bad injuries. I mean, you might break your nose or your up your eye or like. Cut your lip, but you're not gonna have brain damage or but if you fall on your back and the back of your head hits the floor, you could die, like right on impact.
That's true, but you can have orbifrontal cortex injuries, and those are really hard to diagnose because they're just sort of shown by like a change in behavior. Like they're not so much disabled as much as like risk-taking behaviors, having hard like trouble regulating emotions, things like that, that like people with orbifrontal cortex trauma, so like you could damage a little bit, but you wouldn't be sort of like drooling in a wheelchair. But if it was a mental breakdown or a demon or a hallucination or any of them, what a terrifying thing to witness, even if it was in your own head, you know, like,
oh yeah,
that's like fucked.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just like what we were talking about earlier, the sleep paralysis. It can be very, very frightening. Like, it is, it takes a different form from person to person, but it is a form of hallucination. Yeah. It's like...
Sleep paralysis sucks. It's really not nice.
No. Horrifying.
You have it too, as well? Steph was saying earlier that she has it.
Yeah, I've gotten it quite a few times.
It never happened to me, but it happened to a few friends of mine, and I'm quite anxious about it. I really hope it never happens to me. Although, like, I don't know, I've had many hallucinations in my life, and it still happens to me regularly, so I kind of got used to it, and I don't know if it works like that for everyone, but like when I'm having a hallucination, it takes me sometimes a few seconds to realize, like, oh shit, what the fuck is going on? What the fuck is this? Oh, I'm hallucinating. And as soon as I realize I'm hallucinating, the hallucination goes away.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if it's like that for everyone, but like, it's like, what is this?
When you're having sleep paralysis, you feel, it feels like you're awake. So you think that what's happening to you, you're really experiencing it. And even, like, sometimes I don't even hallucinate while I'm having sleep paralysis. The scariest thing is that I can't move, like, no matter how hard I try,
I hate that feeling.
Thing is, like, if I can just manage to twitch the tips of my fingers, like you're panicking, you're like, I can't move. And I think to myself, and you're sending strongest will, like, please move. And when you, I don't know, I mean, the people I've spoken to have the same experience with me, but when you break out of sleep paralysis, it is like you've shattered a wall and you like sit up, like it's like you've broken out of something. You come lurching forward, like gasping for air, because, and I don't know, I can't speak for your experience, but for me, like I get scared and my lungs start to paralyze. And I remember once it felt like something, a lot of my like hallucinations are more of like a presence that I can feel but can't see. And sometimes the presence will come and sit on my chest and crush it, and my lungs will start to paralyze, and I open my mouth to scream, and then my throat closes up and like I'm like, and in that moment I'm like, I'm going to die here. And it's like,
whoa,
it's horrifying.
Wow, it feels like a presence to me. So the first thing you notice is like you can't move, and then basically every time that happens to me where I'm awake and I can't move, I go, okay, I think I'm having sleep paralysis. And then I just try not to like look anywhere where my brain will like place some sort of shadowy thing that's coming out of the wall or window, or because that's what will start to happen. I'll start to think something's coming to get me while I'm paralyzed. And and so even if I close my eyes though, it feels like something's in front of my face waiting for me to open them. So like I do freak out for a bit, and then once I start moving my arms, I go like, okay, it's like it's all good.
You can move a whole, like when you break, you can move a whole arm?
Yeah. Oh, like not fully, but like slowly, and then like, and then I start to wake up.
Mine's like, I know that I can break if I can sort of like lurch forward. But all do you know the feeling, and it's really really hard to describe to people who haven't experienced sleep paralysis, when you're familiar with it, do you know it's coming? You feel
the
weight pull you into that special kind of sleep, that kind of, and you, and sometimes I can break out of it there, and other times the weight is too heavy and you know it's coming and you're like, oh god, like I don't want to, and then you're there and you can't move anymore. And yeah, that like, that's so hard to describe, that weight, that feeling of being, it is like being dragged down into it.
Interesting, yeah.
It sounds kind of like experiencing a panic attack, but not.
But like,
kind of.
As a quadriplegic.
Right, yeah. In the past, when I've had panic attacks, sometimes it makes my arms seize up and I can't move them. So that's I imagine it's kind of like that.
Heavy.
That's interesting.
This is one of my deepest fears. Not sleep paralysis, but like it makes me think about one of my deepest, strongest fears: locked-in syndrome.
You know what
that is?
No, I've not heard of that.
Like the Metallica song.
It's you are fully conscious, but you cannot say anything or move. Sometimes people think you're in a coma, sometimes people think you're like in a vegetative state or something like this. It's not very common, but it happens.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
Mm.
Like you're watching yourself or something.
I mean, you can see and hear everything that's around you, and you're trying to talk and you're trying to move, but you can't. There was a quite good episode in House about this. House didn't always get the medical facts straight, but this episode was pretty well made, according to doctors. I mean, I'm not a medical professional, I'm just an asshole who dropped out of school at 16. It is terrifying. It is terrifying, locked-in syndrome. Like, it's one of the things that I really hope will never happen to me.
That sounds horrible.
That would be terrible.
I heard an account from someone who had it for something like 10 years, not from them directly, but through reading something on the internet. They essentially just felt like they're in a dream state for most of it, and that it wasn't like a perception of time. It's not like every second is this like aching moment of like fear that you're stuck, or like that eventually like the brain sort of reacts in this way of like no perception of time and just you're constantly just in your head. You probably just don't really care about what you're seeing and hearing that much, because it never changes. And
Really interesting perspective of somebody witnessing sleep paralysis from the outside. I really, really briefly dated this guy a few years ago, and we were sleeping next to each other, and I got sleep paralysis. And as I always before do when marriage. I finally get out of it, what was that?
I said before marriage.
Before marriage. It was perfectly innocent. We were all staying at a friend's house. We were sleeping together on the floor. There was nothing sexy going okay. on.
Sorry,
but
I'm sure they didn't hold hands.
No, never. But
sleep paralysis before marriage.
No, so I got
straight
sleep paralysis.
To hell.
And as I always do, I like lurched forward. And I finally came awake to him saying, like, step, step, step. Like, are you okay? Are you okay? Because I was like gasping for air. And I was like, at that point, I actually didn't have a word for sleep paralysis yet. It was just this horrifying thing I experienced. So I didn't really talk about it because I didn't think there was anyone who could understand. And anyway, I was like, yeah, just like a bad dream. And he said that I had been lying down, like asleep, with my eyes open, just going for like gasping for air for about 5 minutes. And I thought, in my mind, that I was like, you know, trying to breathe but not being able to,
laying
completely
still
and also unable to breathe. So he saw me gasping, but in my head I was just trying to get a lungful of oxygen and I couldn't. And that for me was really, really interesting, to have somebody who'd witnessed me have sleep paralysis, didn't know what it was that was happening, That they'd seen me just lying there gasping for air, like staring into space, absolutely terrified, when my perception of what was happening was so different.
It is a lot like a panic attack.
Sounds very eye-opening.
Well, yeah, I mean, panic attacks...
It is a lot like a panic.
My panic attacks are very different, but each to their own. Yeah.
Right.
So it happens to you when you're going to sleep?
Sometimes I wake up with it, but often I can... If it happens
yeah,
when I'm going to sleep.
It only happens when I wake up with it.
I wake up with it sometimes, but sometimes I feel... Because do you know the feeling where you wake up with it, you break out of it, and it's a cycle? It drags you back down and you're in it again, unless you actually wake your brain up completely 100%?
No.
Because for me...
Thankfully.
Oh, it's horrible. It's the cycle.
That sounds
so
like it really sucks.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, I wake up. And I'm gasping and I'm like, it's over, it was just sleep paralysis. Your face feels a bit numb or something. I have to smack myself up the face a bit, just like, wake up, you're okay.
Mm.
So then I lie down, I'm like, I'm all right now. And I go back to sleep. And I feel the weight start to take me again. And it's not sleep. It's if it was sleep, you could roll over, wake up. It's different. And you're like, no, not again. And you're back in it. And basically I'll keep breaking out of it and then being dragged back into it, like a horrible, horrible cycle, unless I genuinely get up, turn the light on, like walk around, have a drink of water, I don't know, like run on the spot for a bit. Like I have to be completely awake and let my brain completely restart the sleep cycle, because otherwise I will have sleep paralysis over and over and over for the rest of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's once I'm in that space in my brain, it doesn't want to let me go.
Awful.
So anyway, who's got another story?
I guess it's me next, based off of what Nelson said at the beginning.
That's
so,
okay with you, yeah.
Yeah, that's more than fine with me. Right, so the story I'm going to be reading today is simply called Footsteps. And I found this on Reddit. Surprise, surprise. So this one's a little bit of a long one as well. So, hold on tight. In fact, the story starts that way. This is long, so I apologize for that. I've never had to tell this story with enough detail to actually explain it all the way, but it is true, and it happened when I was about 6 years old. In a quiet room, if you press your ear against a pillow, you can hear your heartbeat. As a kid, the muffled rhythmic beats sounded like soft footsteps on a carpeted floor, and so as a kid, almost every night, just as I was about to drift off to sleep, I would hear these footsteps, and I would be ripped back to consciousness, terrified. For my entire childhood, I lived with my mother in a fairly nice neighborhood that was in a transitional phase. People of lower economic means were gradually moving in, and my mother and I were two of these people. We lived in the kind of house that you see being transported in two pieces on the interstate, but my mum took good care of it. There were a lot of woods surrounding the neighborhood that I would play in and explore during the day, but at night, as things often do to a kid, they took on a more sinister feeling. This coupled with the fact that due to the nature of our house, there was a fairly large crawl space underneath filled my mind with imaginary monsters and inescapable scenarios which would consume my thoughts when I was awoken by the footsteps. I told my mum about the footsteps and she said that I was just imagining things. I persisted, enough that she blasted my ears with water from a turkey baster once just to placate me, since I thought that would help. Of course it didn't. Despite all the creepiness and footsteps, the only thing that ever happened was that every now and then I would wake up on the bottom bunk despite having gone to sleep on the top, but this wasn't really weird since I'd sometimes get up to piss or get something to drink and could remember just going back to sleep on the bottom bunk. I'm an only child, so it doesn't matter. This would happen once or twice a week, but waking up on the bottom bunk wasn't too terrifying, but one night I didn't wake up on the bottom bunk. I heard the footsteps, but was too far gone to be woken up by them, and when I was awoken, it wasn't from the sound of footsteps or a nightmare, but because I was cold, really cold. When I opened my eyes, I saw stars. I was in the woods. I sat up immediately and tried to figure out what was going on. I thought I was dreaming, but that didn't seem right. Though neither did me being in the woods. There was a deflated pool float right in front of me, one of those ones shaped like a shark. This only added to the surreal feeling, but after a while it seemed like I just wasn't going to wake up because I wasn't asleep. I stood up to orient myself, but I didn't recognize these woods. I played in the woods by my house all the time, and so I knew them really well, but if these weren't the same woods, then how could I get out? I took a step and felt a shooting pain in my foot which knocked me back to where I'd just been laying. I had stepped on a thorn. By the light of the moon, I could see that they were everywhere. I looked at my other foot, but it was fine. As a matter of fact, so was the rest of me. I didn't have another scratch on me, and I wasn't even that dirty. I cried for a little bit, then stood back up. I don't know which way to go, so I just picked a direction. I resisted the urge to call out, since I wasn't sure that I wanted to be found by who or what might be out there. I walked for what seemed like hours. I tried to walk in a straight line and tried to course correct when I had to take detours, but I was a kid and I was afraid. There weren't any howls or screams, and only once did I hear any noise that scared me. It sounded like a crying baby. I think now that it was just a cat, but I panicked. I ran, veering in different directions to avoid big bushes and collapsed trees, and I was paying close attention to where I stepped because by that point my feet were in pretty bad shape. I paid too much attention to where I was stepping and not enough to where those steps were leading, because not long after hearing the cry, I saw something that filled me with a kind of despair that I haven't experienced since. It was the pool float. I was only 10 feet from where I had woken up. This wasn't magic or some supernatural space bending. I was lost. Up until that moment, I thought more about getting out of the woods than how I got in, but being back in the beginning caused my mind to swim. I wasn't even sure that these were my woods. I had only been hoping that they were. Had I run in a huge circle around that spot, or did I just get turned around and start making my way back? How was I going to get out? At the time, I thought the North Star was just the brightest star, and so I looked and found the brightest one and followed it. Eventually, things started to look more familiar, and when I saw the ditch, a dirt ditch that my friends and I would have dirt clod wars in, I knew I had made it out. By that point, I was walking really slowly because my feet hurt so much, but I was happy to be close to home that I broke into a light jog. When I actually saw the roof of my house over a neighboring lower set house, I let out a light sob and ran faster. I just wanted to be home. I had already decided that I wouldn't say anything because I had no idea what I could possibly say. I would get back in the house somehow, clean up, and get in my bed. My heart sunk as I rounded the corner and my house came fully into view. Every light in the house was on. I knew my mum was up, and I knew I would have to explain, or try to explain, where I had been, and I couldn't even figure out where to start. My run became a jog, which became a walk. I saw her silhouette through the blinds, and although I was worried about how to explain things to her, that didn't matter to me at that point. I walked up the couple of steps to the porch and put my hand on the doorknob and turned. Right before I pushed it open, two arms wrapped around me and pulled me back. I screamed as loud as I could, "Mum, help me, please, Mum!" The feeling of being so close to being safe and then being physically pulled away from it filled me with a kind of dread that is, even after all these years, indescribable. The door I had been torn away from opened, and a flash of hope shot through my heart, but it wasn't my mum. It was a man, and he was enormous. I thrashed around and kicked at the shins of the person holding me while also trying to get away from the person who had just come out of my house. I was scared, but I was furious. "Let me go! Where is she? Where's my mum? What did you do to her?" As my throat stung from screaming, I was drawing in another breath, I became aware of a sound that had been present for longer than I'd perceived it. "Honey, please calm down, I've got you." It sounded like my mum. The arms loosened and set me down, and as man approaching me blocked out the porch light with his head, I noticed his clothes. He was a cop. I turned to face the voice behind me and saw that it really was my mum. Everything was okay. I began to cry, and the three of us went inside. "I'm so glad you're home, sweetie. I was worried I'd never see you again." By that point, she was crying too. "I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. I just wanted to come home. I'm sorry." "It's okay. Just don't ever do that again. I'm not sure if me or my shins could take it." A little laughter broke through my sobs and I smiled a bit. "Well, I'm sorry for kicking you, but why did you have to grab me like that?" "I was just afraid that you'd run away again." I was confused. "What did you mean?" "We found this note on your pillow," she said, and pointed at the piece of paper that the police officer was sliding across the table. I picked up the note and read it. It was a running away letter. It said that I was unhappy, never wanted to see her or any of my friends again. The police officer exchanged a few words with my mum on the porch whilst I stared at the letter. I didn't remember writing a letter. I didn't remember anything about any of this, but even I sometimes went to the bathroom at night and didn't remember or even if I could have gone into the woods on my own. Even if all of that could have been true, the only thing I knew at this point was, this isn't how you spell my name, and I didn't write this letter.
I think the only logical explanation is that the Fae tried to steal him and was going to replace him with a changeling child, but they didn't get around to that part. So... ooh. Fucking tricky tricksters. Never give the Fae your name. Never accept the gifts from a Fae. You can't trust them.
That must have been what the pool float was, a gift from the Fae.
And if he'd taken it, he would have found himself either A, betrothed to the fairy queen, or B, hunted for sport, or like enslaved forever in the wild hunt.
But he could have had a shark pool float. Win-win situation.
Wait, so this is another allegedly true story?
Yeah,
allegedly true. I think, to add to the spooky element,
I think they all are. For spooky.
It sounds like an extreme. To me, it sounds like a super extreme case of sleepwalking.
Yeah,
with like combined with like a nightmare.
I think it sounds like a super extreme case of the Fae being tricksters.
Bloody bastards!
Because of the shark thing, it reminded me of that movie Ghost Shark. Have you seen it? It's fucking crazy.
I think I've seen like screen caps of it, and it looked really tacky.
It's just like there's like basically the plot of the movie is like there's this ghost shark, and he can appear wherever there is water. So in the beginning, he starts appearing like in lakes and rivers, and like then it was, and I don't know, maybe it gets better at it. So at some point, you see it like appear in someone's swimming pool, and then it gets completely fucked up, and like it's like just the rain, and the ghost shark is like appears from the rain, and then at some point, the movie keeps getting worse and worse, and at some point people are like, "Oh shit, but we are 70% water," and so the shark starts bursting out of people, and it's like, fuck
man, that must have been one genius shot.
Oh my god.
Okay, here's a theory. The ghost shark was in his toilet, and he also was sleepwalking. So he'd get up, the ghost shark...
The ghost shark possessed him.
It was actually a plastic ghost shark. Abducts him to the woods. In his sleep, he's battling the plastic ghost shark, and then when he is able to bust the plastic ghost shark, he wakes up and then has to just get himself out of the
woods. That's why he was surrounded by thorns, yeah. Because he used the thorns to defeat the pool float
or
ghost shark.
Because he was in the land of fairy.
you're dead set on this fairy thing, aren't you?
I mean, ghost so. Fairies, like, what's the difference, really?
Ghost fairies. Oh, that's
ghost,
another
ghost
level
show.
Entirely.
Ghost fae. Let me tell you, random patches of wood that you end up going in circles in that have, like, thorns everywhere, like, mysteriously. I'm sorry. Like, they're not being slick. Like...
It's like
the Lost Woods. It's like the Lost Woods from Zelda. You just go in one direction, it takes
Blair
you back to
Witch.
The beginning. There are fairies.
It's literally Blair Witch. Tell you what, though, did you guys see the recent remake of Pet Sematary?
No. I have not seen the original.
A little bit
I
of the original book, though.
I've not seen the original either, no.
It was fucking terrifying. It was terrifying. And there was this horrible part where I left the cinemas because I had to go to the bathroom, and I could hear like the suspenseful music coming from in the cinema, and I was already like so wound up because the movie had been so scary, and it's a quiet, like, I'm so embarrassing to be around, it's like a quiet foyer of a cinema, and I'm walking up the steps, I'm about to open the door, and I hear like this noise behind me, and I whip around, and there's this like man behind me who was also in the same cinema, just gone to the bathroom, and I genuinely let out like a small scream and like fell down, and he was like, and he's like, I'm so sorry. I'm like, I just really wound up, man, like this film is really fucking scary. It was like I should have like coughed or something, but I just heard like the softest footstep, and I hadn't seen him, he was just right behind me. I was like, get fucked.
I remember using a DVD, an online DVD rental service back in the day to watch The Birds. I say back in the day, that's one of those weird
10 years ago
things that was around
when people actually used Netflix service.
I think it was about 13 years ago when this happened, and my brother and I had ordered it from like Love Film, I think it might have been.
That sounds like a porn site.
Yep.
Yeah, it does. Love
was
film.
Was it a porn
Ooh.
Film? Did you rent a porn film?
No, it wasn't. It was Alfred... Hitchcock. Hitchcock.
It was Hitchcock's bird.
Oh, yeah. Hitchcock.
It's your cock.
The early bird gets the worm.
I remember seeing... I think there may have been some seagulls in that movie.
Sexy.
Definitely.
And, at the time, I was living in the northeast of Scotland, and anyone who's been in the city of Aberdeen will know that the apex predator there are the seagulls. They will swarm you in gangs and try to attack you for your food.
Like magpies.
Well, they're bigger than the other seagulls in the rest of the UK as well. So they're like, these ones are like Hulk seagulls. And I had one land on my shoulder and snatch like a... fajita out of my hand once, and then whack me in the face with its wing as it flew off.
Damn.
And I had a friend buy like a cheese and onion roll from a Greggs, and he stepped outside, and like 7 or 8 seagulls immediately appeared and started swooping him. So he was like, "I'm not going to fight for this," and he just yeeted that cheese and onion roll across the street, and all these birds just started like pecking at it and fighting each other. And I think Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds hits differently once you've experienced Aberdeen seagulls.
Well, it's magpie swooping season here.
I have a
magpies are tiny.
I have a
here.
Magpie story, at least.
Go for
I went for a ride.
Is it a creepypasta?
I'll try and make
magpies
it creepy-ish.
Magpies are a creepypasta.
I live
tell us,
I live sort of out in the sticks a bit, and I decided to go for a ride to this town that's a little bit out of the way. I'd have no reason to go in that direction or to that town, really. I just wanted to go for a ride. And it has this, like, this really backwoodsy sort of feel to it. Like, you'd start to to come across like the Deliverance sort of type people. I don't know if you've heard of that movie.
The ding 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 ding.
Yeah, but like
I get the reference.
The Australian version of that. And like the layout of the roads didn't really make much sense. Like on my phone, it said there were shops. Like it said that there was a like a petrol station. That and usually petrol stations have like lots of food and stuff. I just figured I'd be able to go into one of those, but it was like a truck petrol station. So like it was just the pumps. And as I was riding looking for at least like a general store, I heard this sort of noise, like this, yeah, just sort of a whoosh noise, and then suddenly it felt like someone had just punched my helmet quite hard, and like I sort of lost my balance for a second while riding and then quickly like corrected, and I realized like I heard it whoosh away again, so I thought, okay, that's a magpie. I just got like hit by a magpie. They swoop at you to defend their nest, and I thought, okay, he's had his fun, and I just kept riding, and then suddenly this second bang onto my head, just really
did
started
you have
throwing
the,
me
the
off.
Zip ties? The zip ties sticking out through your helmet?
No. I guess I'm too new to riding. I just didn't think I'd need it. And
you hadn't crafted the anti-magpie helmet plus one.
This
yet.
Is common enough that Australians have strategies like for.
Yeah. And,
we just googly. I'm not kidding. We have zip ties sticking through our helmet so that when the magpies swoop us, they like can't hit us. This is like
googly eyes as well.
I'll post a photo.
If I ever visit Australia, I'll have to get one of those primer strategy guides for living in Australia.
Because everything in Australia is trying to kill you.
I should write a primer guide.
Including these two right here.
Australians and rats have a lot in common because rats in the wild, their primary predator. I mean, they're not really a prey species. They rarely get preyed on because they're so stealthy, and also they live inside burrows. So, but yeah, their main threat is birds. And
I'm sounding more and more like a rat.
And yeah. And the Australians' biggest enemy is the birds. And we all remember the Emu War and all these magpies' helmets.
Bloody emus.
Okay, it's sent so you guys could all have a look. I have a magpie swooping story. I was in we were going on a road trip, a 6-hour road trip to go see my extended family in Bundaberg, and 3 hours in we usually stop at this same park for just lunch, just Subway or something. And I was younger, so I went into the playground, and it had like the high playground fence so the kids couldn't run off, so like the pool fences. So I was in, and I was like just sitting on a swing, like acting all melancholy and just like twirling myself around on the swing. And this magpie lands in front of me. And I'm not kidding. It was the most fucking angry magpie I've ever seen. I shit you not. Its eyes were red. It like looked at me like.
Yeah, they look angry.
And it, like,
they just
squawked.
Look angry.
And I was like, I'm fucked. Like it. It just landed at my feet, and I'd twisted myself up in this swing so I couldn't just jump off. And it was like. And just like squawked at me, and I was like, oh fuck. So I've untwisted myself and I've started to run away, and I couldn't just like run out of the zone because there was this pool fence, and I was just outrunning it enough that if I stopped for a second to unlatch this pool fence, it'd get me and start peeking my head in. So I'm just screaming at the top of my lungs and running in circles around this playground. And this fucking magpie did not fight clean. It kept landing on pieces of equipment and like taking shortcuts. So I'm doing a clean circle running away from this fucking thing. Mm. And it kept like swooping in front of me and above me and like hit my head with its wings once or twice. It was horrible. Yeah. And it was like such an angry magpie. I'm like, I'm not coming near your nest. I just want to sit on this swing for a bit. Like,
I got chased out of town by them. Absolutely. That's insane. The end of how that whole ride went. They just wouldn't stop. I went to the center of town. I even found the general store and stuff, and they were just waiting for me to leave. So I tried to stay close to trees, and
it's like when the bees are outside the swimming pool in cartoons.
I shot a magpie once.
You what?
Damn right.
I shot a magpie once with a rifle, so you're welcome.
Is that legal?
Legal? I mean, they're not an endangered species, as far as I know.
Are y'all in Australia? Are you not allowed to practice lethal self defense against magpies?
No, we kill stuff.
Okay.
Lethal self defense.
We're not even allowed to shoot snakes, technically, even when they're big bloody Eastern Browns.
I just googled Australian magpies out of curiosity because something in my heart made me feel like my magpie and your magpie are two different things. And
put a UK magpie up there as well.
The magpies we get in the UK look a lot more chill and a lot more like colourful.
Look how angry they look.
Whereas the Australian magpies look like the bastardization of a crow and a skunk.
They're very angry.
Yeah, it's like the difference between European badgers and American badgers.
European badgers be like, "Oh, have you got the time for a spot of tea, old chap?" And,
exactly.
Aren't there literally badgers and like the whole frog and toad shit? Or
Wind in the Willows.
Wind in the Willows, yeah. There's badgers in that shit, right? Like cutesy badgers.
Or like Australian possums and American possums.
Oh, yeah.
I see photos of American possums and those things just look feral.
Australian possums are so cute.
We had this guy's place I used to hang out with. We were mates. They used to all sit out on the porch and there was this possum who used to just hang out and he was affectionately nicknamed Thick Sack Jack because they named him Jack and he had a thick sack. And he just used to hang around everyone while they'd sit around and drink. That was Thick Sack Jack. He was your mate. He just hung up on the electricity wires and just look down at you. They're lovely. They're so cute.
I can just imagine seeing like the Australian and European magpie next to each other. And it's like, who are you? I'm you, but Australian.
I'm you, but better.
Or it's like the difference between
I put a picture of the
sea otters and river otters, which are like it's.
You get sea otters.
Sea otters are massive.
Yeah, but they are very cute and nice. And the river otters, like freshwater otters, are terrifying.
What?
Did you ever...
They're so cute. I've seen photos.
I'm gonna look it up.
Okay, post a photo.
Yeah.
I think they're both cute.
Those European magpies look like hummingbirds. They look so cute.
Yeah, they're cuties.
No, they're not as small as hummingbirds. I would say they're about the size of like a pigeon or a blackbird. They are pleasant. We have like a rhyme about counting them here and everything. I can't remember what the rhyme is, but we have like a rhyme about counting magpies. That's how endearing they are over here.
4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. Is it that one?
Yeah. When the pie was open? No. I can't remember. It's one of these like children's rhymes to do with like, if you count this many, you'll have good fortune. And if you have this many, you'll get married or whatever.
I've heard that. It's like certain amount of birds in a flock or something.
Yeah. But in here, it's particularly about magpies. Mm. And you can tell they're a lot more, you know, loved here.
Actually, I was kind of wrong. It's a specific kind of river otter called a giant otter that is quite. So I'm gonna drop in the chat in the same stuff.
Right.
That's a sea otter that I posted right now in the upcoming episodes channel, and that's a giant river otter.
Oh.
Whoa.
Oh my. That's a feisty boy.
That's a cool image. That's like Godzilla right there.
Feisty.
One of the pictures in that has just been shared. I'll be putting these on the Aneurysm Instagram.
Thank God, yeah. If you are listening and don't want to wait for that, like, please Google, because that thing looks like a dinosaur. That's horrifying.
I think I've seen a picture of one of those giant otters like eating a melon and looking sad before.
Yeah.
Like there's a meme of it.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And it just looks so pissed off at this melon. But yeah, looking at the picture again of those magpies side by side, it looks like one of those science diagrams that look like shit posts because it's like not COVID, yes COVID. Yeah.
I'm in that group on Facebook.
it's a pretty good one. COVID-19.
I think I've literally never seen a magpie at all. Is that sad?
No.
That's lucky.
Do you have them?
That sounds like an American problem.
Yeah, for a ride. Just a casual ride into the countryside.
An American problem or an American blessing? It depends on your magpie.
Same thing.
I think that the most threatening bird I've ever encountered was a goose.
Oh, I wouldn't want to fucking go near.
Yeah, this can be
with razor sharp teeth.
Yeah. You honk. It is a beautiful day in hell.
I was terrified of them when I was a kid. Because, like, I lived in the countryside, in the middle of, like, between farms and stuff like this. And in the southwest of France, birds are a big thing. Like, that's where foie gras comes from. And a lot of stuff like this.
Of course.
And so lots of geese, lots of ducks, lots of all that shit. And I was terrified of them. Like, I was afraid of most animals. I was afraid of pigs. I was afraid of cows. Not sheep.
Cows are pretty scary. I think cows are pretty scary.
Even sheep can be scary, because when you're a kid and it's like, because they you know, they're in how do you say
flocks.
Well, what? They have devil eyes. That's part of it.
Like a flock when there's loads of them.
Correct. Yes, that's what I was trying to say.
A flock. Yeah.
Herd.
Flock of sheep.
The word I was looking for is herd.
Oh, is it a herd?
Yeah.
Yeah, a herd of sheep, not a flock. A flock is birds. Yes. What am I on about?
Walk a flock of sheep.
Of sheep just flying along.
But yeah, it's and sometimes like they.
Now that's terrifying. Sheep birds.
And sometimes they cross the road like this, and like there's like hundreds of them. It's like a fucking stampede, like in The Lion King. I had seen the first movie that I saw in a cinema when I was a kid was The Lion King, and so there was this stampede that I was terrified of, and sheep.
The original Lion King, you saw that in cinemas.
Yep.
Yeah, the first movie.
We're both at that age. We both saw it in the theater.
I can't fathom being that old, so that's amazing. Congratulations.
The earliest film I saw in the cinema was A Bug's Life.
Damn. I was like past my prime. I was like almost too old to go to kids' movies at that point. Hey, it's Giles' turn to tell a story.
Yes.
Yep.
It's called Abandoned by Disney.
Ooh. Let her rip.
Some of you may have heard that the Disney Corporation is responsible for at least one real, live ghost town. Disney built the Treasure Island Resort in Baker's Bay in the Bahamas. It didn't start as a ghost town. Disney's cruise ships would actually stop at the resort and leave tourists there to relax in luxury. This is a fact. Look it up. Disney blew $30 million on the place. Yes, $30 million. Then they abandoned it. Disney blamed the shallow waters, too shallow for their ships to safely operate, and there was even blame cast on the workers, saying that since they were from the Bahamas, they were too lazy to work a regular schedule. That's where the factual nature of their story ends. It wasn't because of sand, and it obviously wasn't because foreigners are lazy. Both are convenient excuses. No, I sincerely doubt those reasons were legitimate. But why don't I buy the official story? Because of Mowgli's palace. Near the beachside city of Emerald Isle in North Carolina, Disney began construction of Mowgli's palace in the late 1990s. The concept was a jungle-themed resort with a large, you guessed it, palace in the center of the whole thing. If you're unfamiliar with the character of Mowgli, then you might better remember the story, The Jungle Book. If you haven't seen it anywhere, you'd know it as the Disney cartoon from decades past. Mowgli is an abandoned child in the jungle, essentially raised by animals and simultaneously threatened and pursued by other animals. Mowgli's palace was a controversial undertaking from the start. Disney bought up a ton of high-priced land for the project, and there was actually a scandal surrounding some of the purchases. The local government claimed eminent domain on people's homes, then turned around and sold the properties to Disney. At one point, a home that had just been constructed was immediately condemned with little to no explanation. The land grabbed by the government was supposedly for some fictional highway project. Knowing full well what was going on, people started calling it Mickey Mouse Highway. Then there was the concept art. A group of stuffed shirts from Disney Co. actually held a city meeting. They intended to sell everyone on how lucrative this project was going to be for everyone. When they showed the concept art, this gigantic Indian palace surrounded by jungle, staffed with men and women in loincloths and tribal gear, well, suffice to say, everyone flipped their shit. We're talking about a large Indian palace, jungle, and loincloths, not only in the center of a relatively wealthy area, but also somewhat xenophobic area of the southern USA. It was a questionable mix at that point in history. One member of the crowd tried to storm the stage, but he was quickly subdued by security after he managed to break one of the presentation boards over his knee. Disney took that community and essentially broke it over its knee as well. The houses were razed, the land was cleared, and there wasn't a damn thing anyone could do or say about it. Local TV and newspapers were against the resort at the beginning, but some insane connection between Disney's media holdings and the local venues came into play and their opinions turned on a dime. So anyway, Treasure Island, the Bahamas. Disney sunk those millions in and then split. The same thing happened with Mowgli's Palace. Construction was complete. Visitors actually stayed at the resort. The surrounding communities were flooded with traffic and the usual annoyances associated with an influx of lost and irate tourists. Then it all just stopped. Disney shut it down and no one knew what the hell to think. But they were pretty happy about it. Disney's loss was pretty hilarious and wonderful to a large group of folks who didn't want this in the first place. I honestly didn't give the place another thought since hearing it closed over a decade ago. I live maybe 4 hours from Emerald Isle, so really I only heard the rumblings and didn't experience any of it firsthand. Then I read this article from someone who had explored the Treasure Island Resort and posted a whole blog about all the crazy shit he found there. Stuff just left behind. Things smashed, defaced, probably ruined by the disgruntled former employees who had lost their jobs. Hell, the locals from all around probably had a hand in wrecking that place. People there felt just as angry about Treasure Island as folks here did about Mowgli's Palace. Plus, there were rumors that Disney had released their aquarium stock into the local waters when they closed, including sharks. Who wouldn't want to take a few swings at some merchandise after that? Well, what I'm getting at is that this blog about Treasure Island got me thinking. Even though many years had passed since its closing, I figured it might be cool to do some urban exploration at Mowgli's Palace, take some photos, write about my experience, and probably see if there was anything I could take home as a memento. I'm not going to say I wasted no time in getting there, because honestly, it took me another year after I first found that Treasure Island article to get around to going up to Emerald Isle. Over the course of that year, I did a lot of research on the Palace Resort, or rather, I tried to. Naturally, no official Disney site or resource made any mention of the place that had been scrubbed clean. Even odder, however, was that nobody before myself had apparently thought to blog about this place or even post a photo. None of the local TV or newspaper sites had one word about the place, though that was to be expected since they had all swung Disney's way. They wouldn't be out there lauding their embarrassment, you know. Recently, I learned that corporations can actually ask Google, for example, to remove links from search results, basically for no good reason. Looking back, it's probably not that nobody spoke of the resort, but rather that their words were made inaccessible. So in the end, I could barely find the place. All I had to go on was an old as hell map I'd received in the mail back in the 90s. It was a promotional item sent out to people who had recently been to Disney World, and I guess since I had been there in the late 80s, that was recent. I didn't really intend to hang on to it. It just got shoved in with my books and comics from my childhood. I'd only remembered it months into my research, and even then it took me another few weeks to locate the storage bin my parents had shoved it all into, but I did find it. Locals were no help, as most were transplants who had moved to the beach in recent years, or old residents who just sneered at me and gave rude gestures the second I managed to say, "Where would I find Mowgli's?" The drive took me through an inordinately long corridor of overgrowth, tropical plants that had run rampant and overpopulated the area, mixed with the native species of flora that actually belonged there and had tried to reclaim the land. I was in awe when I reached the front gates of the resort. Tremendous monolithic wooden gates whose supports to either side looked like they must have been cut from giant sequoias. The gate itself had been gouged in several places by woodpeckers and eaten away at the base by burrowing insects. Hanging on the gate was a sheet of metal, some random scrap, with hand-painted letters scrawled in black, "Abandoned by Disney." Clearly the handiwork of some past local or an employee who wanted to make some small protest. The gates were open enough to walk through, but not drive. So grabbing my digital camera and the map, whose flip side showed a layout of the resort, I set off on foot. The inner grounds of the place were just as overgrown as the entryway. Palm tree stood untended and ragged amongst piles of their own coconuts. Banana plants similarly stood in their own stinking, bug-riddled refuse. There was this sort of clash between order and chaos as carefully planted rows of perennial flowers mixed with obnoxious tall weeds and stinking blackened mushrooms. All that remained of any outdoor structures were broken. Rotting wood and various charred bits of unidentified material, what was most likely an information booth or an outdoor bar, was now simply a pile of assorted debris chopped by past vandalism and ravaged by weather. The most interesting thing on the grounds was a statue of Baloo, the friendly bear from the Jungle Book, which stood in a sort of courtyard in front of the main building. Frozen in a jovial wave toward no one, staring into empty space with a silly, toothy grin as bird shit covered whole swathes of his fur and vines ensnared his platform, I approached the main building, the palace, only to find the outside of the building covered in graffiti where the original paint hadn't peeled and chipped away. The front doors weren't just open, they had been taken off their hinges and were stolen. Above the front doors, or the gaping maw where they had been, someone had once again painted "Abandoned by Disney." I wish I could tell you about all the awesome stuff I saw inside the palace. Forgotten statues, abandoned cash registers, a full-fledged secret society of homeless bums, but no. The inside of the building was so stark, so bare, that I actually think people had stolen the molding off the walls. Anything that was too big to steal, counters, desks, giant fake trees, they were all resting amid this empty echo chamber that amplified my every step like a slow rat-a-tat of a machine gun. I checked the floor plan and headed to all the locations that might seem in any way interesting. The kitchen was as you'd imagine, an industrial food prep area with all the appliances and space, no expenses spared. Every glass surface was broken, every door knocked off its hinges, every metal surface kicked and dented. The entire place smelled like very old piss. The huge freezer, not even remotely cool now, had row upon row of empty shelf space. Hooks hung from the ceiling, probably for hanging cuts of meat, and as I stood inside for a moment, I noticed they were swinging. Each hook swung in a random direction, but their movements were slow and small that it was almost impossible to see. I figured it had been caused by my footsteps, so I stopped one from swinging by clutching it in my fist and then carefully letting go. But within seconds, it started to swing once more. The bathrooms were in much the same state as the rest of the place. Just like the Treasure Island Resort, someone had methodically smashed each porcelain commode with coconuts and other implements. There was about a half inch of rancid, stinking, stagnant water on the floor, so I didn't stay in there very long. What's odd is that these toilets and the sinks and the bidets in the ladies' room, yes, I went there, all dripped, leaked, or ran freely. It seemed to me that they should have shut the water off long, long ago. There were plenty of rooms in the resort, but naturally I didn't have the time to look through them all. The few I did peer into were similarly wrecked, and I didn't expect to find anything there. I thought there was actually a television or radio in one room, as I really think I heard a quiet conversation coming out. I thought it was like a whisper, probably my own breathing echoing in the silence, or just another case of the sound of flowing water playing tricks on the mind. This is what it sounded like. Number one, I didn't believe it. Number two, short, unknown reply. Number one, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Number two, your father told you. Number one, unknown reply, or possibly just weeping. I know that sounds ridiculous. I'm just telling you what I experienced. Why I thought there might have been something running in that room, or worse, some vagrants who had holed up there and probably would have knifed me. At the front doors of the palace again, I figured I hadn't found anything of note and had wasted the trip up. As I looked out the door, I noticed something interesting in the courtyard that I had apparently missed. Something that would give me at least one thing to show for all my troubles, even if it was just a photograph. There, as a lifelike statue of a python, maybe 80 feet long, coiled up and sunning itself on a pedestal right in the center of the area. It was almost time for the sun to start setting, so the light fell onto the object in a perfect way for a photograph. I approached the python and snapped a photo. Then I stood on my toes and snapped another. I moved closer again to get the details of its face. Slowly, casually, the python lifted its head, looked directly into my eyes, turned and slithered off the pedestal across the grass into the trees, all 80 feet of it. Its long head disappeared into the woods before its tail even left the sunning spot. Disney had released all their exotic animals onto the grounds. Right there on my floor plan map was the reptile house. I should have known. I read about the sharks at Treasure Isle, and I should have known they'd done this. I was dumbfounded, just utterly stupefied. My mouth must have been hanging open for the longest time before I came back down to earth and snapped it shut. I blinked a few times, backed away from where the snake had been, back towards the palace. Even though it was totally gone, I still wasn't taking any chances and backed my way into the building. It took a few deep breaths and slaps of my own face to get myself right in the head again after that. I looked for a place to sit down as my legs were feeling a bit like jelly at this point. Of course, there was no place to sit down, unless I wanted to recline in the broken glass and dead leaf carpet or haul myself back up onto a desk of questionable reliability. I had seen some stairs near the palace lobby and decided to go have a seat there until I felt better. The staircase was far enough away from the front of the building to be relatively clean, save for a startling accumulation of dust. I pulled a wedge of metal off the wall, once again painted with "Abandoned by Disney" motto I'd become accustomed to. I placed the wedge on the stairs and sat on it to keep at least somewhat clean. The stairway led downward, below ground level. Using my camera flash as a sort of improvised flashlight, I could see that the staircase ended in a metal mesh door with a padlock. A sign on the door, a real sign, read, "Mascots only, thank you." This perked up my spirits a little bit for two reasons. One, a mascots only area would definitely have some interesting stuff back in the day. Two, the padlock was still in place. Nobody had gone down there. Not the vandals, not the looters, nobody. This was the one place I could actually explore, and perhaps find something interesting to photograph or wantonly steal. I had come to the palace essentially agreeing with myself that it was okay to take anything I wanted because, hey, abandoned. It didn't take much to bust the lock. Well, actually, that's wrong. It didn't take much to bust the metal plate on the wall that the padlock was hooked to. Time and decay had done most of the work for me, and I was able to bend the metal plate enough to pull the screws out of the wall. Something nobody else had apparently thought of or hadn't been able to do at the time. The mascots only area was a startling and very welcome change from the rest of the building I'd seen. For one, every second or third fluorescent light overhead was illuminated, even though they flickered and faded randomly. Also, nothing had been stolen or broken, even if age and exposure were definitely taking their toll. Tables had notepads and pens. There were clocks, even a punch-in clock on the wall complete with filled-out time cards. Chairs were scattered around, and there was even a small break room with an old static-filled television and long-rotted-out food and drink on the counters. It was like one of those post-apocalyptic movies where everything is left in the state of evacuation. As I walked the maze-like sub-basement hallways of the mascots-only area, the sights just became more and more interesting. As I went further, desks and tables were knocked over, papers scattered and almost melded with the damp floor, and a large carpet of mold was slowly overtaking the real rotting crimson floor covering. Everything was just sort of squishy. Anything wood disintegrated into mush when I applied even the least amount of force, and clothing items hanging on hooks in one of the rooms simply fell to moist threads if I tried to unhook them. One thing that annoyed me was that the light was becoming more sparse and unreliable as I went further into the dank, suffocating depths of the place. Eventually, I reached a black and yellow striped door with the words Character Prep 1 stenciled on it. The door wouldn't open at first. I figured this was probably where the costumes were kept, and I definitely wanted a photograph of that twisted, stinking mess. Try as I might, whatever angle or trick I tried, the door wouldn't budge. That is, until I gave up and started to walk away. That was when there was a slight popping sound and the door creaked open slowly. Inside, the room was completely dark, pitch black. I used the camera flash to look for a light switch in the wall by the door, but there was nothing. As I made my search, I was jarred out of my sense of excitement by a loud electrical buzz. Rows of lights overhead suddenly flashed to life, flickering and fading in and out like the rest I had passed. It took a second for my eyes to adjust, and it seemed like the light was going to just keep getting brighter until the bulbs exploded. But just when I thought it would reach that critical stage, the lights dimmed a bit and steadied. The room was exactly how I pictured it. Various Disney costumes hung on the walls, fully put together like strange cartoon cadavers hung from invisible nooses. There was an entire rack of loincloths and native clothes on hangers towards the back. What I found odd, and what I wanted to photograph right away, was a Mickey Mouse costume at the center of the room. Unlike the other costumes, it was lying on its back in the center of the floor like a murder victim. The fur on the costume was rotten and shedding, creating bare patches. What was even odder, however, was the coloring of the costume. It was like a photo negative of the actual Mickey Mouse. Black where he should have been white, and white where he should have been black. His normally red overalls were light blue. The sight was off-putting enough that I actually put off photographing the thing until last. I took a picture of the costumes hanging on the walls, upward angles, downward angles, side shots to show an entire row of frozen, putrid cartoon faces with some plastic eyes missing, and then I decided to stage a shot, just one of the bedraggled characters' heads on the slick, grimy floor. I reached for the headpiece of a Donald Duck costume and carefully removed it so the thing wouldn't fall apart in my hands. As I looked into the face of the wide-eyed, moldering head, a loud clattering sound made me jump with fright. I looked down at my feet, and there between my shoes was a human skull. It had fallen out of the mascot head and shattered into pieces at my feet. Only the empty face and lower jaw remained, staring up at me. I dropped the duck head immediately, as you'd expect, and moved for the door. As I stood in the doorway, I looked back to the skull on the floor. I had to take a picture of it, you know. I had to, for any number of reasons that may seem silly, but only if you don't think it through. I'd need proof of what happened, especially if Disney was going to somehow make this go away. I had no doubt in my mind, right from the start, that even if it was just gross negligence, Disney was responsible for this. That's when Mickey, the photo negative opposite Mickey in the middle of the floor, started to get up. First sitting up, then climbing to its feet, the Mickey Mouse costume, or whoever was inside of it, stood there at the center of the room, its fake face just staring directly at me as I mumbled, "No," over and over and over. With shaking hands and a violently thrashing heart and legs that had once again turned to jelly, I managed to lift the camera up and aim it at the opposite creature, now quietly sizing me up. The digital camera's screen displayed only dead pixels in the shape of the thing, It was a perfect silhouette of the Mickey costume. As the camera moved in my unsteady hands, the dead pixels spread, marring the screen wherever Mickey's outline moved to. Then the camera died, went black and quiet and broken. I raised my eyes once again to the Mickey Mouse costume. "Hey," it said in a hushed, perverted, but perfectly executed Mickey Mouse voice. "Wanna see my head come off?" It started to pull at its own head, working its clumsy, glove-clad fingers around its neck with clawing, impatient movements similar to a wounded man trying to pull himself free of a predator's jaws. As it worked its digits into its neck, so much blood. So much thick, chunky yellow blood. I turned away as I heard a sickening tearing of cloth and flesh. Only cared about getting away. Above the doorway, out of this room, I saw the final message clawed into the metal with bone or fingernails, abandoned by God. I never got the pictures out of my camera. I never wrote the blog entry about it. After I ran from that place, I fled for my sanity, if not for my very life. I knew why Disney didn't want anyone to know about this place. They didn't want anyone like me getting in, and they didn't want anything like that getting out.
Get fucked!
That's awesome.
Oh man, that took a turn.
That was so fucking creepy.
That was a pleasant kind of tenseness. I enjoyed that one a lot.
It was worth it. It was worth all the build up.
Wherever the big house of mouse get involved, things always get a bit, you know, a bit spooky.
Creepy.
Where it says
that was fucking creepy.
Where it says like that the costume says, "Hey, want to see my head come off?" But in a perfectly executed Mickey Mouse voice.
"Hey, want to see my head come off?"
"Want
to see my head come off?" "Oh, folks."
"Oh, hi." Yeah. I thought about it, but I'm like, no, I'll destroy it if I do this like crappy Mickey Mouse impression.
Wait. Do your sloth impression again.
Yeah. I can't remember what that noise was, but yeah, that's... yeah. I can't remember.
My God, when like the human skull came out, I was like, get fucked.
For some, like, so I was getting that that frisson, you know, where you're like your spine feels tingly. I was getting that when he mentioned that the claws were swinging in the freezer, and that like he stopped it, and then it started swinging again. For some reason, that was enough for me to just go like, "Ooh, that's uncomfortable."
I like hate like poisonous animals and things like that, and like the realization that he was like standing where the reptile pit had been, and they just released them everywhere. I was like, I would have left then. Like, I'd have been like, "Are you joking me? I'm going to get like face to face with some random snake that's going to come out of the shrubbery." Like, I don't think so. Like, that's what I'd have left.
You can only hope that it would be suffering from reptile dysfunction.
Oh.
Oh.
But if you hate venomous animals, what the fuck are you doing in Australia?
That's where I was born.
Yeah.
Don't have the money to go elsewhere.
Excuses.
You can unborn yourself in Australia.
Whoa. Fuck.
How do you do that?
This is just a provocative thing to say.
Did you mean it as like suicide or like crawling back inside your mom's?
You live in America. I don't think you can't tell me when to unborn myself. You're like, you can unborn yourself from Australia. You live in the USA. Where is your high horse? Like, I'm sorry, telling you that you live in the United States of America is just enough of an insult. Like
the USA.
You know what? Oh. It's like your life is so sad. It's like you live in the United States of America. Eat that.
Oh, what's that? I've got one really weird little cough or like a really minor little problem. You know what? Just to be safe, I'm just going to run to the doctors and it's not going to cost me a thing.
Oh, no.
Go in there.
Frontier medicine out here.
Oh, we can do that here in the UK, but we'll be waiting a while.
Yeah.
Oh.
Chew that.
I had to schedule my own MRI and pay for that.
Oh, I didn't pay for my MRI. I mean, you have to schedule it. Like, I was like, "Hi, I'm due for an MRI," and I scheduled it, but, like, I didn't pay for it.
I actually...
If I guess if it's... It might have been part of a diagnosis, so they, like... But whereas mine was just like self.
You just wanted a random MRI.
I was getting migraines. Okay. So yeah, I really wanted one. They didn't think it was necessary.
See, this kind of brings me on to something that's kind of related to both the story and hospitals.
Nice.
About 4 or 5 years ago, I explored an abandoned hospital with some friends.
Oh man,
That's so haunted, so deeply haunted.
It had to have been about 1 or 2 in the morning, I think. And
why?
Because it was in a town called
Boys Will Be Boys.
It was in a village called Bankery, which is not too far away from Aberdeen in Scotland. And it was a condemned abandoned hospital. So it's now been destroyed. It isn't there anymore, which is sad because I would have loved to have gone there again someday. But like the I have some photos somewhere. If I can find them, I'll share them with you sometime. But there were like books and pages all like scattered across the hallways and like. Where it had been so damp, most of them had like stuck to the floor. There were stairways which were so rotten and fucked up that like you could try and climb up them, and I could feel them almost giving way under my feet. And I was probably the heaviest.
Man, that's enough.
I was probably the heaviest of my friend group there. So I'm like, you guys feel free to go up there, but I'm staying down here. And I stayed on a floor of a hospital by myself whilst my friends went and like explored. We each had like a massive industrial torch that we'd brought with us. It was one of the coolest moments ever. Getting into the hospital was probably the scariest moment because I'm not particularly good at climbing, and we had to get in through like a broken window because a lot of the front bits had like been barred up, and there were a lot of these planks like across the doors and everything where it had been nailed into place. It was really, really cool. I would love to do something like that again. I've only ever been to one abandoned building since in Dundee. Not Australia Dundee, which I'm sure there's probably one of, but Scotland Dundee.
Crocodile Dundee.
And
this is annoying.
It was an abandoned printing facility.
That's not a knife.
But most of the walls of this printing facility had been torn down, so you could like climb up into it. And you could be several floors up and there would be no walls. It was that was pretty awesome as well. Kind of freaky being that high up without any like walls there or anything.
I'm going to say something. Yeah. I think you deserve to be killed first in a horror film with that kind of behavior, honestly. Honestly, like, how did this happen? All I did was break into an abandoned, definitely haunted hospital at 2 in the morning.
Oh man.
Well, Lisa, it's your turn, I believe.
Okay. Well, I'll give you guys a choice. Do you want to hear me play Hotel California on my kazoo or read the Guy Fieri Creepypasta?
Oh, Guy Fieri Creepypasta.
Guy Fieri.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right,
Guy Fieri.
Take us to Flavor Town.
Do any of you listen to Last Podcast on the Left?
Nope.
No, but it's on my to listen to list.
Okay, cool. Then I won't. You won't have heard this already, maybe. Okay, so I heard this one because I had a boss who was really obsessed with Last Podcast on Left, but it's from Reddit. So it's called My Curse, My Flavor Town 2, Flavor Bound. I sat on the floor of my kitchen in a circle of candles. Wreathed in the shifting, flickering light, I was working on opening the device. It was triangular in shape and made of wood or metal. It was tough to say. The puzzle had what appeared to be representations of pepperoni and cheese on it. Somehow, I had to reconfigure this into a pizza slice if I wanted to open the portal to Flavortown. Hours passed. I was making progress, twisting a pepperoni here and realigning some cheese there. I moved my fingers along the crust, and almost imperceptibly, I felt a click. I knew I was almost there. I spun the crust around, and suddenly, I heard the tolling of distant bells. Taco Bells. And a glowing, almost neon, blue light started to pour in from nearly every crack and seam in the room. I heard the cans of Mountain Dew in my fridge explode. The various bags of chips and other junk foods started throbbing and pulsing. They too eventually burst open. I turned to my right and suddenly there was an open doorway where just seconds ago there was a blank wall. Fog filled it, and it was lit by that same blue light. I couldn't make out anything past the entrance, but I knew this was my ticket to Flavortown. A man-sized shape formed in the fog that I could barely make out. It started to approach me and eventually stepped into my kitchen. The stories were true. The pizza puzzle had been solved, and the mayor of Flavortown himself, Guy Fieri, was now in my house. He looked different. He wasn't wearing the bowling shirt. Instead, he had on some kind of latex and leather contraption that did not fit him in the least. He was pouring out of the outfit, his blubber bursting through small square holes.
Oh, the real creepy person.
It almost looked like the holes were purposely tightened around the flesh as blood leaked from them, and the skin was blackening as if dead. He had his trademark sunglasses on and the same hair, but his overall skin tone was now bluish gray. He had spatulas and other cooking implements tied around his considerable waist. "What are you?" I asked. "An explorer in the further regions of taste. A demon to some, angels to others." He took a step toward me and extended his hand. "Come, you solved the slice. You must come with me and taste our pleasures." I declined to take his hand, but I followed him nonetheless. We walked for what seemed like eons through labyrinthine corridors. My sense of smell was being constantly assaulted by new and varied scents. Some amazing, some so bad I couldn't even imagine what they could be coming from. The corridor finally opened into a wide plateau. Above everything, there was a gigantic floating burrito. It was impossibly large and could be the origin of the various food smells. Flavortown seemed like it would be a lot nicer than this when I heard the stories. The burrito let out a loud blast of sound, almost like something from a foghorn. My mind could barely comprehend what I was seeing. "No, this is mine. The god I serve in this world and yours. The god of flavor, hunger, and grease. My god, Burrithon, lord of Flavortown." I gasped for air. The stench of this massive shifting burrito was starting to overpower me, starting to make me have flashbacks of meals past. "This is what you wanted. This is what you wanted to taste, to smell. You wanted a one-way ticket to Flavortown, and now you have one," Guy shouted and chuckled. Behind me, I heard a noise, like greased-up ball bearings moving a slab of wood. Guy took a step towards me and declared, "My god wants someone to taste what it's created, and I brought you." He shoved me hard in the chest, and I fell back, landed immediately in what appeared to be an open, upright coffin of some kind. Something restrained my arms and legs. I had a split second to look down, and I saw oversized forks and spoons holding me in place. A sharp, stabbing pain erupted from my side, and I saw a tube full of what looked like Crisco impaling my side, pumping me full of the substance. More spoons and forks held my head in place with my mouth open. An arm made of what looks to be sausage and bacon dropped down in front of my face, jamming itself down my throat. I couldn't breathe. The smells and pain were overwhelming. I blacked out. I awoke being held at a 45-degree angle, still restrained, although now my head was free to look around for all the good that it did me. The room was nearly pitch black. Guy approached me with a grin plastered on his cold face. He removed his sunglasses, and I saw that his eyes were sewn shut. I gave up a lot to become what I am now. Sight is meaningless to me, so I cast it off. It's all about that taste, brother. I'm going to show you the light, and then you're going to join my culinary cabal. I'm going to knock your socks off with this fresh take on a classic. When I put this in your mouth, you're going to feel like an ATM, because this is money. He stepped out of view and returned with a wheeled table, not unlike those you would see a cadaver on in the morgue. It was covered in macaroni and cheese. He took a large spoon off his belt and thrust it into the heaping mound, then turned to me and shoved it into my mouth with a dispassionate look. The spoon shattered one of my teeth. He loudly shouted, "Ka-ching!" Through the blood and enamel, I could taste the cheesy mess. My sanity must have started to slip, because it really did taste good. After I swallowed, he filled my mouth again immediately. This time, it tasted slightly different. Better, somehow. There was a hint of something that I couldn't quite place. I chewed more and realized that it was bacon. I looked at Guy, and he grinned again. "You're tasting that bacon yet? It really kicks it up a notch, huh?" He started making sucking sounds with his mouth, then smacked his lips, belched, and ate some of the mac and cheese himself. That bacon is made of long pig, if you know what I'm saying. I looked down and saw that strips of flesh were cut from my torso and legs. This and many more horrors were to be my fate for all eternity. It looks like I got myself into nothing but trouble.
What? Like, that was so stupid, but it made me so uncomfortable. Like, I feel a little ill.
I love the genre 1-2, the comedy horror punch, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that really got me going.
Ooh, like, I feel like a bit ill. Like, it reminded me, actually, it triggered a memory of a nightmare I had when I was a kid, of being like, it was like triggered. I had this nightmare because I watched a Simpsons episode where like Homer goes to hell and is force fed donuts forever, and like I had this nightmare about being force fed, and it fully triggered how like afraid and like out of control I felt as a kid. I know, it was like, oh, like don't bring that back. But then it's like, you tasted that bacon yet, brother? And I'm just laughing again, like I'm so confused about how I feel.
What's the tone?
It's all about the power of flavor.
Welcome to Flavor Town. Asked for it.
Oh, I ate a burrito yesterday. I can taste it again. Oh no.
The bit that really killed me was when you said the burrito made a noise.
Yeah, like a foghorn.
Yeah, they're like MLG.
Rice.
That's literally the only creepy pasta I've ever heard before today. So
that macaroni sounded like some creepy pasta.
Oh.
Yeah. I never made that connection before.
Oh no, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
I recommend reading the Ben Drowned creepy pasta. Oh. That was one of the first ones I was introduced to. It was way too long for me to read on this episode, but that's a really creepy one. That,
I like that one.
The details are well presented. The possibility of it is quite high, and like, it's, yeah. It just, there's a bunch of different like peaks of creepiness.
It really helps that like fans of the creepypasta have remade scenes from the creepypasta in modded versions of the game.
Yeah, there's video.
Accompaniment, like it's for the uninitiated, it's a Legend of Zelda creepypasta. It's about a haunted copy of Majora's Mask.
This guy goes to a garage sale and sees a really cheap copy of Majora's Mask, the Legend of Zelda game. and the guy keeps on like lowering the price so that he'll buy it, and just like, yeah.
I like how a lot of those video game ones always start with like a shifty garage sale. You know, always some shifty dude trying to get rid of his haunted game in his yard or something.
Yeah.
Because in every kid's heart, they're worried that their parents are going to sell their Nintendo 64 while they're out of the house or something.
Yeah. Well, this has been very spooky.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Follow us on Instagram. We have an email address now. It's aneurysmpodcast@gmail.com. We're going to be uploading the photos from our discussions of European magpies versus Australian magpies onto Instagram, as well as the cute otters versus the terrified ones. You can find that on our Instagram as well if you dine to follow us.
Don't forget, you can't have a top text without a bottom text.
Yeah. Happy Halloween. Have fun.
Stay hydrated.